some of the challenges facing the church. There's a shortage in priests, I believe, aren't there?
We'd like, but you know, every organization would like to have 100 more leaders than they've got. But yes, well, our concern in this diocese at the moment is we will lose a third of our priests in the next 5 years in retirement, because they're all right at that age of 70 to 75.
Mm-hmm.
And about a third of our priests are at that age. So they're all going to have to be replaced somehow.
How about the seminaries? Are they not?
We have, I think, 18 men in the seminary at the present time. But remember, like 5 of those 18 men are freshmen in college. They've got 8 years before they're ordained.
Right.
And if you've got 5, only 2 of them are going to be ordained. So, rural Oklahoma, as you are very well aware of, is dying. We have parishes in Krebs, Idabel, Hugo, Durant, all those places down there. In another 10 years, are those towns even going to exist, let alone be big enough to have a Catholic parish? So the need for some of the rural priests is going to be different too. There are two things happening at the same time.
Right.
Yeah. Because like most of the parishes that we've closed, we've closed missions in southern Oklahoma because there aren't any people left. I remember when a good friend of mine, one of my former associates, was pastor of the mission in Lehi, Oklahoma. And there were 3 ladies, 2 sisters and a friend, who were the only parishioners in that parish.
Hmm.
Now, other people came there to Mass because of the convenience. That's where Saturday evening Mass was. So Colgate and some of those people came. But they came to the pastor and said, "You've got to close this place. We can't take care of it. The 3 of us just can't do this anymore." So they had a big celebration of the life of that parish and all that, and closed it up, and they all went to Colgate to Mass.
Wow. That was sad for them, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. But it was nice that they were wise enough to know, we can't keep this up. They've since we've changed. There's no pastor in Colgate anymore either. They still have Mass once a month there, but as far as there's not enough people.
Yeah.
So that side of it is one side. Then the other side of the clergy thing in the United States is, while we'd love to have more priests, we have a very large group of permanent deacons, men that are ordained deacons. And a permanent deacon in the Roman Catholic Church can preach, he can do weddings, he can do funerals without Mass, he can give instructions, he can do baptisms, he can do a lot of the things the priest does. And we've got a whole lot of those. So it's kind of an interesting thing how we balance those
mm-hmm.
out.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring more women in.
Well, there is some discussion of whether or not we could ordain women to be deaconesses.
Yeah.
It's not a happy discussion most of the time, but it's at least a discussion. We will look and see, have women bishops and women priests saved the Episcopal Church?
Say that again.
In recent history, the Episcopal Church has opened their ministry to women.
Yeah.
And if you look at the Episcopal Church today, has that reality saved that congregation? They're losing just as many people as we are.
Right.
The dynamic is pretty much the same. It's very interesting to see it.
Women in leadership isn't just the Catholic Church.
Oh, no, it's all across, well, across right. the board. And leadership doesn't necessarily mean the priest that consecrates the bread and wine. You know, I think one of the things that people don't realize is that in the 1950s, Roman Catholic nuns were some of the most powerful people in this country. They were heads of universities. They were heads of hospitals and huge medical programs. I mean, Sister Therese Goschalk at St. John's Hospital was as powerful as any woman in this town. More powerful, in a sense, than the bishop.
I'm very proud that I interviewed Sister Goschalk.
Oh, did you?
And I have it in
good.
Voices of Oklahoma.
What a precious person she was.
From Germany, and she said we'd have to salute Hitler. So we have this political, cultural division in our churches, and say, how did you navigate that? Because we have conservatives, we have progressive dealing with church issues, but politics as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel it. How did you handle that that had to be a challenge.
Well, especially when I was the pastor of Christ the King Parish and Frank Keating and James R. Jones were running against each other, and they were both members of the parish. It was a very interesting 3 years. I was also, I gave James R. Jones communion the day he was elected our
representative from this district. Right.
Because he came to Mass at Holy Family that day.
All right.
And so I've dealt with all of those, all of my priesthood, and what I... My job is not to take sides publicly. My job is to be available to the needs of either one. I had to stand in the pulpit of Christ the King and order a group of people out of the back of the church with their things, because I said, this church is Frank Keating's parish church. This church is James R. Jones' parish church. They both have a right to worship, and they are to be here comfortably. So those of you in the back of the church that are here to protest against either one of them, get out of my church.
And that took care of that?
They ran like mice. It was, and then one Sunday I got really tickled. I was praying in the front of the church. James R. Jones was at the wrong Mass. He was at Mass where he'd never gotten. He was sitting in the pew. And Frank Keating comes down the aisle with his kids, one on each hand, and he sees James R. Jones in the view, and he turns around and goes all the way to the other side of the church.
Oh, really?
Oh, it's just funny. And I'm standing there trying to keep a straight face. It was just funny. But you have to, you know, St. Paul says we are to be available to everyone. And part of you just keep your mouth shut. It's none of anybody's business.
Well, right now, politically in this day and age, it's such a dividing issue.
It's awful.
More than it's been for many, many years. And so I think people are even choosing their friends or unchoosing their friends because of the politics that's so severe.
It's tragic. Yeah.
And I'm sure you've even felt that in your ministry, that see this happening. And and I don't know what advice you can give. I don't think you can change anybody's mind.
And the worst thing you can do in my business is try to. Most of the people at that level of intensity for their political opinion are not at all rational.
Yeah.
The rational part of their life has gone away. And that's not just Republicans or just Democrats or, you know, it's the whole crowd. It's
so as you are looking back, what gave you the most joy of your service to your church?
Continuity of ministry to the folks. In this next 2 months, I gave Father Robert Williams his first communion. Father Robert Williams served Mass for me for 12 years at Holy Family. He has now become a priest. His father, I taught at Bishop Kelly. There's a huge, long connection. His grandmother, after his grandfather died, became a nun. And I was her spiritual director for which communion she would go to. That continuity of being part of those families as you see the whole church. In October, I will baptize, I think, 3 little kids and marry a young man in the church who, when I first came to Holy Family, was 3 years old. Mm-hmm. And at a daily Mass in the little chapel downstairs, while I am standing there saying the holy prayers, he comes up and wraps himself around my leg at the altar and won't let go. And his grandmother's there trying to get him. It's those histories.
Yeah.
It's that continuity of it's the fact that I've been part of their lives is why he's getting married in the church. The fact, you know, it's there's a history like that all over the place. And you get things like, you'll get a call, and somebody will say, well, Father, da, 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 and I go, how do you know me? Oh, well, Father, I've been sitting in the last pew at Holy Family Cathedral for the last 15 years. I've never introduced myself, but you have to bury my mother because you're the only one she ever liked in the pulpit.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because there's so much going on out there in that pew about me that I don't know.
Yep.
But just to be aware of that, and it raises its head periodically, and you go, oh, well, I guess I better do this funeral. You know, it's that connection thing with, because, you know, it goes back, and I'm very pleased with this. It goes back to the decision I made at 17 years of age. Two most important things in my life are my love for people and my love for God. And now, what, 60-some years later, I'm still helping folks know God and God be available to folks.
Yeah.
That's pretty satisfying.
And then those people who reach out, that's your reward, isn't it?
Yeah. Or that reach out and say, you know, they're in real big trouble and they just need to talk to somebody and I trust you. That's huge. And some of those are just people who trust me because they've heard me preach.
Well, that would be the only way they would know you, many of them.
And many, you know, and then others are kids I taught at Kelly. And,
right.
But you know, that kind of thing. But for some of them, it's literally, you're the only priest I've heard I'd trust with this.
Because they never wanted to come up and actually meet you.
Yeah. I had a most marvelous experience with this once. You know, when you do the how to become a Catholic thing, huge in that whole year is, I'm not making my first confession. I'm not going to go to confession to some priest. I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. And so I just say, well, just calm down and stay. We'll see what happens in the end. So we went through this whole year of this with this one person. So on the Saturday before Palm Sunday is when all those people make their first confessions. And we do a retreat that day, and then we go to the box and hear confessions for 3 or 4 hours. And I noticed this person was at the retreat, sitting there, and I thought, well. So I sit there, and I hear half the confessions. The other priest in that parish hears, Monsignor Halpine hears confessions. We all hear confessions. And so I'm there about 3 hours, and I'm ready to leave. I hadn't have anybody in for about 5 minutes, so I thought, well, they must be all finished. I can leave now. As soon as I get up to start to leave, all of a sudden, through the door comes this person, and they slam it, and they sit down. And I go, oh, I thought you weren't going to do this. Well, I'm just going to try it. I said, okay, sit down. And then we kind of began. And the confession went on and went on and went on and on. About halfway through, I got the look. I've never told anybody in my whole life the stuff I'm telling you right now. I've never told anybody. I said, well, you've needed to. This needs to come out. So anyway, we continued. We finished the whole thing. And I did what the priest does. I gave absolution and so forth. And the person got up off the chair and came across the room and grabbed me on both shoulders and shook me and said, being a Catholic's gonna be great! Oh, my God. So those are very satisfying moments. Those are very satisfying moments. It was just a delight the next day to give that person their first communion. That was wonderful.
Confession, of course, Protestants don't understand that. Oh, I mean, we have our own.
It's very hostile. Yeah,
we do it our own way. Mm-hmm. But I just the word cathartic came to me that some of these people are getting out and talking as they would maybe to a counselor, mm-hmm. and telling you things, and maybe they get relief. I'm sure they do. Yeah. As a result of it, just to talk out loud to somebody about it.
Oh, sure.
And you're the point of contact.
Yeah. We save a lot of people money. I think it's one of the reasons psychiatrists don't often like Catholic priests.
Right.
And also, the other thing that you hear from people, and these aren't necessarily Protestants coming into the Catholic Church or Catholics coming back, because an awful lot of the people that you hear they've been atheists or they've been agnostics or they just haven't cared one way or the other. And the thing that you hear a lot in that is, I love these classes. I love these classes. Because she says, every night I go home and I realize somebody out there loves me. Mm-hmm. And I have never had an awareness that somebody out there loves me, and it actually is God. I have no awareness of that. And sometimes they'll look at you and they'll go, and you don't even know what that's like, do you? Because you've always had it. They're mad at me because I've always known God loved me. You know? But it's new to them, and it's immensely consoling. you know, would you want to live your life without believing that
God loves you?
Yeah. Oh, what a way to live. Or that there is a God that cares at all.
Well, they also probably went a long time in their life they didn't care.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah.
And then finally it sunk in that nobody loves me.
And also a lot of that sinks in when the first child is born.
Okay.
What do I want to give my child? Do I want to give my child that it's all over when he closes my casket?
Yeah. I think of many, many songs that are written about the love of God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not sure about the songs that you have, but the Protestants have all these gospel songs.
Oh, yeah. And we've stolen a lot of them now that we've gone to English.
Okay.
Because I don't know what we would have done when we first went from Latin to English. I don't know what we would have done without the Methodist songs, because the Methodist theology isn't that different than ours. And so we could take a lot of the Methodist songs. So we sing a lot of our English songs that we sing that we think are ours, we stole from the Methodist hymnal. Not so much from the Baptist hymnal, but from the Methodist hymnal.
I've often thought, while sermons and homilies can be really effective at the moment,
songs are lasting.
You took the words out of my mouth. They're the ones that are lasting, right?
They're the thing that goes over and over in your brain.
Hey, they do.
Yeah.
And for some reason, at my age, and I can still run, these songs going way back to my childhood that I can remember, I don't remember the words, but the melodies are coming back to me.
Uh-huh.
And I can't sing, but in my brain I think I can. These melodies are coming to me.
Well, I hope for your sake that it comes back to you strong and clear. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so.
Right.
I mean, because I learned that from my Presbyterian neighbors.
And I learned that from my mother's knee.
Yeah, and I learned from my Catholic sisters that taught me that the reason that I existed was to know, love, and serve God in this world and be happy with Him forever in the next. It was a basic question in the Baltimore Catechism.
Yeah, and I had Martin Luther's Catechism.
Oh, you did?
Right.
Okay, so you would have been probably much the same, because our Baltimore Catechism that we had in this country for years and years and years was simply a German catechism translated into English.
Yeah.
So it has to have had at least some taint of Lutheranism.
A taint, yes.
A taint. That's the Chillicothe, Missouri, that my father grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
The tracts divided the Lutherans from the Catholics.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there weren't anybody else. The Lutherans and the Catholics, they were the two Germans.